The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another installment, the fourth one now, of Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. It is June 30th. We are halfway through the year of 2012 already. It's been a very good year for me personally, but no better than previous years for our white people's survival outlook. My guest and I will be talking about this very thing. He is David Bailey, a perceptive man and quick study on what's behind the world events that occur and the explanation we are given by the media for them. He has not been slow to grasp what is really going on. David utilizes a Facebook page for his business. You can find him under Associated Tradesmen. I found out that he's also a musician and plays with a band. I don't know how he does all that he does, because he also keeps up quite an internet presence and communicates with a lot of people here and there. And so I can tell you that I'm really happy to have David on today's program. And after you hear him, I'm sure you will be too. Hello, David.
Hi, Carolyn. Nice to be on your show.
Well, it's as I said, it's nice to have you. Is there anything you would like to add to what I said or correct about what I said? And also, the first thing I want you to do is tell your own story, so you might just incorporate it into that.
Okay, sure. You don't have to add anything more to what you said. That's more than enough. To use a Yiddish term, I'm just a schmuck. I just happen to have my eyes open, I think. And I think what really alerted me to the major danger that we're in is what happened on 9/11 and all that's come of it since. But to start from the beginning about myself.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you here already, because I forgot in there to mention your website, so that people, if they want to take a look at that right now, while you're, you know, talking, to get some idea, along with your Facebook page, is NEMW.net. That's it, which stands for New England Media Watch, which is something that you've had for a while now. And I noticed that you probably don't have time to work with it a lot, but it's still, you still keep it up fairly well. So that's, folks, that's NEMW.net. That's David's permanent website. Okay, David, sorry about that.
Sure. Well, right now the website is functioning more as a storehouse for data, different books, different things. Like, I do have Mein Kampf on there, an audiobook file broken down into 15 or 20 minute segments. I forget where I found that online, but I've made a point of listening to it over and over again. If I'm stuck in traffic or whatever, I keep it on my iPhone, and just to hear certain things. And the man was a brilliant thinker, and he saw even then the dangers that were coming Germany's way. And I think by extrapolation that he saw the danger coming the way of the entire white race. And I think that's why you see a lot of people pick up on that, and they are adherents of the 14 words and by David Lane and so on, because now it's become more obvious. When I was a kid, you know, I'd hear lots of stories about the KKK and neo-Nazis, and everybody's always acting like those are bad things. And there's no doubt that at a certain point, the KKK became a liability. But, I mean, we already know that the FBI infiltrated the KKK and were committing violent acts just to make them look bad. But to get back to the beginning of my story, I was born in 1962, and my mother was a Czech immigrant. As well as my uncle, they escaped from Czechoslovakia. It was called Czechoslovakia at the time. And another fella, they were sponsored by my grandfather, who had escaped Czechoslovakia at the end of World War II. And he had cut, though my mother was not aware of it up until fairly recently. My grandfather had been working for the Gestapo in routing out the communist insurgents that were operating in Czechoslovakia. So if he hadn't escaped, he would have no doubt ended up on a lamppost with a lot of other people that had met that fate, unfortunately. So they escaped after being sponsored by my grandfather. They managed to, they were supposedly only going to Austria for student activities and ended up hightailing it to Germany. And from there, they ended up coming here. And so that's my mother. And I think ultimately what happened as far as shaping my perception is I understand from my mother and my uncle and my grandmother, who showed up a year after I was born, what communism really was. And I think a lot of people today, I suppose a lot of people back then didn't even know how bad communism truly was and how bad communists truly are. But
I agree with that. They didn't.
Yes. No, and they didn't play it up that
they
much.
They still don't, you know.
No, they bury it as best they can. They don't. You never see them outlaw communist parties.
No.
You know, so there's probably a reason for that, and I'm sure we all could figure that out why. But the as I was growing up, I developed a strong dislike for, obviously, the USSR, and that was interchangeable with Russians, though the USSR itself was an empire that had lots of different groups of people within it. A lot of Asians were in there, and a lot of other Eastern European people were involved with that, as well as the Jews, who were at the top of the whole political structure. And my grandmother had made no bones about the fact that as she was growing up, she was born in Moravia, which is part of what you call the Czech Republic. There's Bohemia and Moravia. And she was born a country girl, more or less, in 1909, actually. So she had been already born and lived through the First World War and saw the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which, till the day she died, she had a great love for and kinship for, and felt really saddened by its loss. In my mind, the way it sounded like a Disney movie. I know other people like Alex Jones or all these other people are saying that these were Habsburgs were inbred and whatever. You know, they say a lot of nasty things like that. But the fact of the matter was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, by and large, was what you'd expect of a principality type of structure in the heart of Europe. And she also lived through World War II, obviously.
So she was a different, you know, there were different groups. Some of the Czechs they were nationalists, they wanted separation, but a lot of the Czechs were quite happy in that empire, which really treated everybody fairly.
Absolutely.
Basically, yeah.
And absolutely.
Being persecuted. And that was an important element of the Habsburgs' thinking. They were the ruling, they were the royalty. They saw everyone, all of these various nationalities that were combined there, along with the German Austrians, as their people, you know, their subjects, and their idea was to do what, you know, was to make their subjects happy and to keep the empire going and also their continued control. But I think because they thought they were the right people to do it. So, that's interesting that your grandmother is one of the ones who saw it that way.
Oh, absolutely. And don't forget, Prague and Vienna were sister cities. They were basically two hubs. I mean, at that point, they were basically two cosmopolitan hubs of this empire.
Mm-hmm.
And that went back a couple centuries, actually. I mean, if you watch... The interesting thing about, say, a movie like Amadeus is that, I mean, it goes over the fact that Amadeus was traveled through that whole area from Vienna to Prague, and everybody loved him everywhere they went. He went, and I mean, my grandmother lived. If you've seen the movie Amadeus, they did all the opera scenes in the actual opera house in Prague. And my grandmother, during the war, lived in a apartment building right across the street from there. So she was a couple really? Floors up. Yeah.
You know, David, I had the opportunity to visit Prague in, I think it was 2009 now. And of all the cities I went to in Germany and Austria and Poland and Czechoslovakia and Czech Republic, Prague was my favorite. What a city that is. Fantastic place.
Well, it's barely touched, even during the war. And now it's technically, I would say it's probably owned by UNESCO, by the United Nations.
Yeah.
So they it's more or less like one of these cities. If you go to a Mayflower city, you know, it's Prague is pretty much kept to be a Baroque period type of place that you can visit for historical reasons. So, but it is a beautiful place. There's no question of that. So that my grandparents lived right in the hub of the activity down there in Prague. And my grandfather was actually of Ukrainian origin, and his family was driven out of the Ukraine right after the First World War, obviously, because of the Bolsheviks, because of the communists. And they were an aristocratic family, so all my the side of the families were named Haleko. They were driven out of out of the Ukraine anyhow, and they ended up in Poland. And my grandfather, Nestor, ended up in Prague going to the Charles University. And he spoke seven languages and was an engineer, became a professor at the Prague University. And while he was there, because he spoke seven languages and he was of Ukrainian descent, he was tapped by the Gestapo to help root out the communist infiltrators. So he posed as a Ukrainian officer ahead of the coming Soviet forces and kind of convinced the underground that he was there as a liaison as the Red Army was approaching. So he managed to get a whole bunch of them caught, no doubt, and maybe some of them were killed. I don't know. I'm not going to cry over dead communists. But the fact of the matter is I do know other Czechs that, in fact, I know one Czech, and he lives in Canada. His father and uncle were involved with the underground, and they weren't communists, but they were nationalists. And his uncle and father were, in fact, captured by the Germans and put in prison, and that was probably about the last year of the war. And they weren't killed. I don't know if my grandfather was involved in getting them captured or not, but they were only imprisoned, and they themselves ended up fighting against the communists, and both of them ended up dying. One was shot trying to escape from the Soviets, and the other one died in prison. So you can't tell me that those evil Nazis were any worse, or certainly weren't worse than the communists.
No, it's my impression that that the Czechs were pretty felt pretty much okay under when the National Socialists took over all that Czech territory, what had been Czech territory, as a protectorate. And that was why the British wanted to get Reinhard Heydrich killed. They wanted to create some big thing. You know, another false flag thing, really, in a sense.
Absolutely.
To stir up Czech anger against the National Socialists because they were too content and happy, and they even said that. So you had the British with those Czech government in exile, or
the government in exile,
yeah,
the Benish,
the Benish people there, and they planned this thing out, which was only going to cause the Germans to have to retaliate and do something, you know, in return for that, which they did. But now that's just another German atrocity. Okay, sorry for the interruption. This is
no problem. I like when you interject.
Okay.
Yes, because we should reinforce the history of that, because indeed, Edvard Beneš was working with the British all the way back to World War I.
Yes.
He was an academic, and, you know, academics, you know, where a lot of Jews are involved with the academic field and always have been. Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt that there was a little political scheming and whatnot going on. And in fact, those men that killed Heydrich were trained in Britain and dropped in Czechoslovakia to do that, to actually assassinate them. And then you had the incident in Lidice, where obviously the Germans had to do something, and they had to make a point of being heavy-handed, because just the one time to say, this is what will happen.
Yes.
Now, a lot of people will point fingers at Lidice or these other situations with the Germans did this, the Germans did that. I don't see any Americans, or that many Americans, complaining if a roadside bomb goes off in Afghanistan or Iraq, that a platoon of American soldiers will go and kill everybody they can in the nearest mile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people complain about it, but by and large, you don't see most Americans running around saying we're Nazis. You know, so
it's acceptable when you have people
when you do it.
Part of partisans fighting outside of the regular armed forces, which is what all we deal with now, but not then. And that if you have the right to, they're illegal. You know, they're the ones committing the criminal acts. So, and then you have Britain encouraging that, just like with the. Now I'm getting off the track, but just like in France after the German victory there, the British and with American help actually too encouraged the French resistance, which was illegal because France, the government of France, had agreed with Germany to cease fighting. They agreed to all the terms. They agreed to the German occupation, and the Germans weren't harming the French, but you know they didn't want the French to give up, so they did that. Now that was what was illegal of the British and the Americans to support an insurgent movement.
Absolutely.
Resistance movement. But we don't want to get so far away. So
No, I don't want to get that far away for sure, but I just want to illustrate the point that when your own country is doing that, it's okay.
You know, yeah.
For the most part. For most people, you're doing what you have to do. Now, we know, I've met other people. I know a Greek guy who worked in the Greek Secret Service before he moved here, a military police. And he knows Greeks that would say the same thing. The British were over there, you know, sponsoring insurgency among the Greeks as well. They were all over Europe sponsoring these uprisings and insurgencies, and they made off with a lot of Greek gold while they were at it. So the British have a very black hand in a lot of stuff that goes on, and they still do, I think. But nonetheless, my grandfather ultimately had to escape when the Reds came in, and I found out in retrospect ultimately that and very recently, that my grandmother intended to bring my grandmother and my mother and my uncle here or escape with him. And my grandmother didn't want to leave. My grandmother was afraid of leaving and going off into the unknown. Mm-hmm. So,
guess your grandfather would be considered today one of the war criminals, right? One of the Nazi collaborators or something.
Oh, well, The funny thing is, he ended up here in the States, but if you go and Google him online, you'll find FBI records of him saying exactly that he was a Nazi war criminal.
Yeah.
A Nazi collaborator. He's on a list, and he's also in a black, what they call the black book that was in Czechoslovakia that the communists printed. He's one of the agents. I think his number was 451 or something like that. So, they knew who he was, and they wanted him, that's for sure.
They would still consider him that. If anybody wanted to honor him in the Czech Republic today, he would say, oh, no, not that war criminal, that Nazi collaborator. Well, it's good that you can be proud of him.
I am, certainly, yeah.
Yes, you are, yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm proud of him, too.
But ultimately, he came here. I don't know the whole story. I met him once, and only when I was a child. My mother was, even though he sponsored my mother and my uncle to come here, my mother never took a shine to him because my mother thought that, I mean, she didn't know the whole story. My grandmother, I don't think, knew the whole story that he was involved with the Gestapo. I think she thought he had too many political beliefs, and that was enough. Mm-hmm. And she didn't realize exactly how deep he had gotten involved with what was going on and why he had to flee the country. That certainly wasn't the crux of what I grew up knowing about him. What I grew up knowing about him was that he'd abandoned his family. And my mother was of that mind too until very recently. You know, but she didn't stay in touch with my grandfather like my uncle did, and she didn't want to talk about my grandfather. So that's the unfortunate thing. I met him one time. He was, I guess, very taken by me, and he called my father, and he had a lot of money here. He actually was working for the U.S. government, despite the fact he was on an FBI list. Mm-hmm. He ended up working for the U.S. government on the Nautilus project. He was one of the head designers of the turbine system for the Nautilus submarine.
Wow. Well, he was quite a highly educated man.
Yes, he was. And so he had a lot of money, and he actually called my father and offered to give my parents a down payment for a house, and my mother didn't want any part of it. So that the door was closed to knowing anything more about my grandfather, unfortunately, until very recently. So I grew up basically under the tutelage of my grandmother, and because both my parents worked, and my grandmother did work part-time for a company here in around Boston, outside of Boston, called Transitron. They were making missile parts. That's how dedicated to being anti-communist my grandmother was. She worked for a company that was making all the transistor components for Patriot missiles or something at the time, maybe Minutemen, and raising me. And, certain things would get out of her mouth about communism and about atrocities, though she never told me graphically what she'd seen. I found out later stories about people being hung from lamp posts and shot in the streets. It was a very horrible scene, what had gone on over there. And that's nothing in comparison with anything people can claim about the Germans, what they'd done anywhere. So that was my main thing. I grew up having a kind of an attitude about communism. I wanted to go to West Point up until the time I was 14, and then I probably got a little too into, wanting to be a rock musician or whatever, having, like we all do, we follow what goes on in the media. My stars, my heroes were the Beatles and stuff like that. And then once you get into that, then you get into their political beliefs and whatnot and develop pacifist ideas. And go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just said yes. Yeah, I'm just...
Okay. Just developing pacifist ideas. But I also looked at the situation, and I remember I was born in 62, so I was in high school in the mid-70s, and seventh and eighth grade. Up until that point, up until seventh, eighth grade, I had a dream of going into West Point. I wanted to be Patton. I have a fondness.
That's normal.
Well, I got into building model tanks, and one of the reasons I kind of looked fondly on Germans is I follow my perspective on history came more from a military perspective, and up until I don't know how long they started really changing it, but they always up until the '70s portrayed German military men as very honorable people. They did, even in our media, even in our history books. I mean, I watched World at War and all these different things, and I was a big fan of tank warfare. I could tell you every kind of tank and how much it weighed and all the variations of each tank. So I was very into that, and then after a while I started getting into this more pop mentality. But not to deride that, but even from a conservative perspective, and I still had that, even though I developed kind of a pacifism. I still have a conservatism in my thought processes. And I looked at what was going on in Vietnam, and I really couldn't understand the motivation for being there. Being Czech, obviously, I knew that Eastern Europe was under the communist boot.
At that time, yes.
Yes, and to me, I already started feeling that there was a hypocrisy that this government is run on, because I'd already heard stories about how Eisenhower said pray when the Hungarians rose up. The Prague Spring happened in 1968. You know, I knew about that. I heard about that. I understood what was going on. And that was after two wars that we'd gone into with Korea and Vietnam, and also the trouble with Cuba over communism. And yet I couldn't understand why we cared about Asian countries being communist when we were allowing our own white countries to be communist and being under communist boot. So I started having issues with that. And then, of course, obviously we pulled out of Vietnam, and you kind of wonder why would we be involved with a conflict and with a country that's so small that we could have defeated them very easily if we really tried. And then to just pull out after wasting so many American lives, and 55,000 dead, 100-some-odd thousand wounded. And my uncle was one of them. He was almost killed there as well. So it became a question of really wondering, what is this government really about? And I started to really feel that there are a lot of problems that with this country itself, that I wasn't about to go to West Point and get involved in a situation where I'm going to allow myself to be sent somewhere for some dubious reason to probably get killed or maimed. I no doubt a selfish reason, but maybe if had I done it, I'd be in a position now where I would have some kind of authority as a military officer. I don't know. We have plenty of military officers that don't seem to be doing anything of any worth for their country at this point, except to just take orders and do stupid things that our government tells them to do.
I think it's very difficult to get anywhere in the military and to move up and to still have independent ideas about, you know, wanting to change things. I don't put a lot of hope in that because if people can't see now that our government is traitorous, if it's not bad enough, then I don't know that anything's going to happen when it gets even worse or even more obvious. So, I just think that you can't get ahead just like in any every other area. If you have different views, and it's going to come out somehow. Look what happened to Tillman. Here I go again. But, you know, that I've always found that just amazing. And I knew right away that the story they put out about his death wasn't true. So he was talking too much. He was expressing his views. He was too honest of a man, and they knew what his intentions were, so they got rid of him. I mean, it's hard to hide it. He didn't try to hide it very much, I guess. But even if somebody was, you know, realized, still, it's going to come out. People are going to tell on you. You know, people you might confide in, and when they're looking for that, and they like you say, the kind of people that get advancement. They're not the most impressive people that they have there.
Oh, no doubt. And I think it's very interesting that what I've heard of Pat Tillman was that he was very much in touch with Noam Chomsky. So I don't know who else he was babbling to, but he certainly was babbling a lot to Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, I thought he could trust Chomsky.
Yes, exactly.
Anti-war person and all this stuff. And yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. But Noam Chomsky, of course, is a Jew, and Noam Chomsky, he says a lot of things about the American Empire, and he'll say things about Israel, but he doesn't really go too much into Jewish power.
I think he's a gatekeeper.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what I've come away with. When I initially got into the whole 9/11 thing, I downloaded a bunch of talks that Noam Chomsky had and a couple of debates he had with Dershowitz. And I remember at the beginning of one of the debates, Dershowitz made a sly comment at the beginning of the debate where he said, don't get too perturbed with Noam, because he, after all, was raised on a yeshiva or whatever they call him anyhow, kibbutz or whatever. So I think basically he was giving the audience a nudge and a wink, you know, this is for show mainly what we're doing. Nothing's going to change. We're just making it look good. That's the impression I got, you know. But So just to fast forward, I guess, to the present, I had known my grandmother had said many times that the Jews were responsible for ruining Europe, and there was no question that that's how she felt about the issue. On the other hand, she did have a fellow that was Jewish and married to a Christian woman that lived in the same apartment building as them. And when the Germans were looking to deport them, she kept her mouth shut about the fact that he was a Jew. While she was off working, he would babysit my grandmother's two kids, my mother and my uncle. But at the same time, she held the belief that the Jews were responsible for destroying Europe. There was no question of that. So I think it goes back to an earlier statement you made about Goebbels and the German people. Everybody has a favorite Jew. Mm-hmm. I think when once you know one personally, you take a shine to them. You know them as a person. You interact with them as a person. And like all friends, I think we all have friends that you know they'll vote for Democrats or they hold certain liberal beliefs or vice versa. If you're a liberal, you know your best friend might be more of a Republican, but you overlook that to maintain your friendship. Right, because you're personally involved with them.
Yeah, and you know, maybe this particular Jewish man who was married to a Christian, maybe he wasn't dangerous in any way, and maybe he wasn't a problem. But you never know. What it's very interesting to find out how many will go along with all the lies that are put out just because they are Jewish, even though they don't have any personal experience with knowing that that's true. So. This is one of the prickly problems that we have to deal with.
Sure. Well, they won't go out of their way to say that. I mean, to even acknowledge that Jews have so much political power. I mean, in this country today, right now. I mean, we won't even get into historical things. We know what was going on in Germany during the Weimar years. We know what happened afterwards, after World War II. Prior to that, they were doing the same thing in Slavic countries. The Slavs, even before the Germans woke up, the Slavs were already itching to get rid of Jews. And my grandmother said that the Jews were basically no different than gypsies. They just happened to be a smarter gypsy. So, I mean, that...
Yeah.
you Fair. Know.
So, that I would. That's a pretty good statement.
Yes. So, there was no question. And I was... Because of her, I was exposed to being canny about Jewish media control at an early time in my life. Mm-hmm. I would say in the early 70s, when you had shows like All in the Family coming out, I remember very well my grandmother saying to my father, especially, pointing out certain things she'd see on TV and say, "See, that's what the Jews were doing to us in Europe. That they control, they're controlling the media. That they're giving us their story and making us appreciate them." And my father used to chuckle at that. My father used to think that was a bunch of hogwash, you know. But my father, I think, was more of a Judeo-Christian. He was turned on by Billy Graham in the late 50s and developed that kind of, I guess, Jew worship that a lot of Christians, unfortunately, are stuck with today. So even today, I could say something to my father about Jews or Jewish power, and he'll run away like his butt is on fire. So,
you know, I went through all those stages or phases. I've been through so many stages and phases from the time I was a teenager, even, you know, where I guess always open to some way of thinking or looking at the world, looking for my own Weltanschauung, and which I realize that's what it is now. And but I never stayed. I mean, I went through them all. Just kept moving on, moving through. I never got stuck there.
Yeah, well, so, that's the idea. You've got to keep your eyes open and your mind open. Too many people, unfortunately, that once they think they know something, they think they actually know something, and they stick to it, and you can tell them the sky is blue and somebody else has already convinced them the sky is pink, and you can keep pointing to the sky and saying, "No, that's blue," and show them a piece of paper with blue on it, and say, see, that's blue, and they'll say, no, it's pink, because it's already embedded into their mind that way, and there's very little you can do outside of deprogramming them like a cultist.
And I think that, you know, to expect that all, let's say, all white people say, oh, we're smart, we're a smart race, we're brilliant people, and you know, we've done all this, and all these people need to wake up, and you know, I think that's unrealistic. They're not going to, because they're not the brilliant people of the white race. I'm not saying that there's, you know, I mean, of every race, there's some brilliant people who are the leaders, and most people are always following. And if most people don't have that desire to question as much, and you know, once they get something in their mind, as you were just saying, they're satisfied to stay there, and they really don't want to be pushed out of it. So I don't think that it's right to say, well, this is a fault. We need to get whites to do better, and it's whites' fault. They're not being what they should be. They're degenerating. Well, we look back in the past and we say, look how the people used to be. Well, most of the white people then were not. It was still always the brilliant ones who were leading the way, or those who just could take on intellectual issues and so on, plus had a lot of leadership skills and courage and so on. That doesn't mean that everybody does or will. And so we have to get off this idea that there's something wrong with whites, and we have to realize that it's the influences that we're getting, and we have to have our own moral societies and our with our own values to influence our own people, and they'll be just fine, you know?
They need to be reprogrammed. I don't think people actually vote to have a leader. I think people actually vote to find – they vote for people that are most like them already. And that's the biggest problem with democracy, is that most people are not, like you said, are not leader material. Most people aren't most white people, they might have 100 IQ. But most people focus on day-to-day living and focus on themselves and focus on their immediate surroundings and what's best for them. And they also function off of what has already been ingrained into their minds. And that's why most people will vote for a George Bush, who was certainly no, you know, brilliant physicist. They'll vote for Obama, who, you know, says a lot of things that people want to hear, because most people want to be good. Most people have been trained to think that racism isn't good, that being charitable to everybody isn't good, even if it means to be charitable to people that aren't your own and letting your own live in the streets. Most people are easily swayed by that because they want to be seen to be on the right side of the discussion or right side of an issue, you know?
You know, I've got this news item that I put at the bottom of my notes here, thinking I'd bring it up maybe towards the end. But, you know, I'm gonna bring it up now because it's come up. You're talking about people voting and Obama. And this one was a story, you know, that's because we have all these election stories. But I think of this as to vote or not to vote. You know, there's a lot of recommendations that we should ignore the electoral process and not vote. And I have a pretty positive view of that. And yet they always pull you in. And here's what they did with this story. It says if Obama does not win a second term in November, he risks losing both the law and the core of his legacy. You know, that's all they care about is their legacies. Republican Mitt Romney will try to gut the law. They're talking about the health, immigration. Oh, which law are they trying to talk about? The health care law. Mitt Romney will try to gut the health care law that's just been, approved and impose something else. All the rest of what Obama accomplishes will fall under the dim review of history assigned to a one-term president. So here they're bringing us into this thing. Oh, well, if Obama wins, then he's going to, you know, be seen as a great leader. He's going to keep his programs. If we can get Mitt Romney to win, then we might change the whole legacy of Obama and change everything. And so then they pull you in to being a partisan Republican or Democrat, to that it's important, and you start working for Romney, say. in order to beat Obama, and that might be the right thing to do. See, I get undecided because I've decided I'm not going to pay attention to any of them. I don't care what they do. They're all the same. You know, we're always saying they're all the same. I don't know how much this may be another one of these things that's not fully thought through. But then we get pulled into the partisan politics again between Republicans and Democrats.
Oh yeah, it's a soap opera.
Yeah, is this the way that, you know, this is how they do it. And they're going to bring up issues, very divisive issues. They'll bring up the immigration thing, too. And they'll say, well, if Romney doesn't win, we're going to have all this thing with Obama. Then if Romney wins, we find out he's going to do the same thing. And we find this out over and over again.
But nobody wakes up.
No. Well, it's still a way to kind of rein us in to their system, their electoral voting system, like, oh, let's work hard for this candidate and let's send him money and let's do this and that. This, I think, is a real dilemma, and I think it should be discussed amongst our movement quite a bit. And, you know, like, I have this sister-in-law who I like very much, but she insists on Obama. She says, When I tell her what's wrong with him, and she'll say, yeah, but he's saving my Social Security. She's afraid she's going to lose her Social Security under the Republicans. And now she's probably afraid that she's going to lose health care. She's not even on it yet, but, you know, that the Republicans are going to. So she wants these programs because she thinks she's a poor person, which she's not, actually. But she used to be. She grew up poor. She thinks she's a poor person who needs all this. You know, I mean, and she's not stupid. She pays, she is stupid because she watches, gets all her news on TV, and she reads her local newspaper and listens to the local radio station talk show. Not the national ones, but this local one. And they're probably not too, probably fairly liberal. So, you know, she's happy with that. She's not on the internet. She doesn't have a computer. And there you are. I mean, and then they give you these decisions to make. They give you this choice between this and the other, and they start to make it out like it really makes a difference, you know. Right. And it's hard to resist that. It's hard for me to resist thinking now. Well, maybe I, of course, one vote. I don't know, but maybe I better go and vote for Romney. Well, I hate doing that.
Yeah, well, that's the situation they put us in because they say you vote for the lesser of two evils. Well, you don't win with either one because both are evil.
That's right. And we should vote. We should walk away from it. But, you know, I just thought this was interesting because already I read that and I thought, well, there it is. You know, I could be convinced that I better get involved and support Romney.
That's right. I mean, how many people wanted to make how many people that voted for McCain truly wanted McCain?
Nobody.
They
did,
right. They were more afraid of Obama than they were of
McCain. Well, I didn't vote for McCain. I voted for some libertarian third party. See, now I wouldn't do that. I just vote for the third party knowing it won't win, but just, you know. But the last election, the primary, it was the first time in my life I didn't vote. And I almost went out at the last minute because there was one candidate, a local thing, that I thought I should vote for, but I didn't. Of course, he lost. He was going to lose anyway. So that was the first time. Got me in the habit already.
Yeah. Well, and that's how it goes. But look at Romney. Massachusetts is the only state, I believe still the only state, that has an imposed health insurance regime. So if anybody's...
Which state?
Our state, Massachusetts.
Oh, that hasn't imposed.
No, we have it, yes. Romney put it in place before he left to try to become president.
<That's right. laughs>
He was the governor of Massachusetts. Yeah. So anybody out there who thinks that he'll repeal anything that Obama did as far as health insurance, that's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. He imposed it on us here first. And they might change some of the features of it, but it'll still be a health insurance. What it is basically you're forced into buying health insurance one way or another. You have to buy it. So you're paying into a system, whether you want to or not, so that they can, you know, take care of baby daddies and all these illegals that come here that need health care. And sure. I personally haven't been to a doctor or a dentist in 10 years. So,
well, and I go to my dentist, but I don't go to doctors.
Every time I
would start thinking, I better get a doctor and go or see a doctor about this or that. It's always been a waste of time, and they didn't help me a bit. And so if you don't go, you know that you're responsible. This is how I feel. And you do a better job of taking care of yourself, knowing that you don't have that safety net to fall into. Or are you saying, well, if I have a problem, I'll go. That's why people get lazy about themselves, because they think that the doctors in the hospitals and in every other area that you can, you know, that's similar, will take care of them, which is wrong thinking.
Of course. And more often than not, that they create other problems.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So you know.
I'm very happy with my taking care of myself. I do a pretty good job.
Yeah, I mean, if I get deathly ill, I'll let God determine what happens to me instead of end up on a machine for 15 years, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's easier for everybody all around.
Well, there are things that doctors can do, and there are things that medicine can do. I wouldn't want to be, you know, somebody that says, oh, never go to a doctor. Certainly, can't think what they're called now, but bone doctors, you know. If you break a bone, you better go see a doctor and have your bone.
Oh, well, of course. I mean,
but it's all this internal medicine stuff that people are just, they just depend, they love, these older women that I hear, they love their doctors, and they talk about them and what they're taking and what they're doing, and they have so many complaints, you know, and I don't have any complaints, and I don't want to have any complaints.
Right.
And so, like you, again, well, all right, so you're still, you were always like, you got into music as a young man, and yeah. And instead of just listening to music, like you do with everything, you got involved in it and did it yourself. So are you a drummer? Is that what you?
No, I'm a guitar player. I play lots of instruments. Oh. My best friend is a drummer.
Oh, it's your friend that was the drummer. Okay.
Yes, my friend is the drummer. Yeah, I met him in '88 when he was fresh out of high school, and we've been together ever since, on and off playing. Ever since, so yeah, I write original music, all sorts of different things.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
yeah, of course, I don't have much time for it every day now, but I try to come up with a new song every couple of days to harass my son.
Well, that's kind of amazing. A new song every couple of days.
Well, I do. I come up with a little.
And you
little
play with it. You have a band or a group that you play with, right?
Yeah, from time to time, like I said, my best friend is he's got two very young girls, so he's also a union electrician, so he's got a lot on his hands too. So we don't dedicate the time we used to in the old days, but yeah, we try to keep going. I'm trying to rebuild my music studio down my basement so I can start recording new songs again and try to have some fun with it. You never know what'll happen. I'm sitting on an album we recorded in 1995 that I never finished, so I probably should get around to doing that, too.
Well, good for you. All right. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, then. We've got about 11 minutes left in this first hour. Oh, and ladies and gentlemen, please let me tell you now, if you – I haven't even checked. I'm going to check now. I get carried away listening. Here's something from somebody. That's not a question. Okay, if you have a question for David, send it to Carolyn at CarolynYeager.com, and I'll be able to ask it to him. And before we go to our 1 hour, our 5 minute break between our hour one and hour two, I'll ask you. What was I going to ask you? Yeah, what was the first thing that what began to wake you up or draw your attention toward all the things you pay attention to now and start with the website and all of that?
Okay, I would say I was kind of a grumbler up until 9/11. I've already been through one marriage and whatnot. I'm trying to do the band thing, trying to keep a job, all these things, raising a kid, getting divorced, getting remarried. So I didn't have a lot of time to, like, when you had, Who's that fella that's a big fan of Dr. Pierce?
Hadding Scott?
Hadding, yes. I think Hadding probably has been kept his hand active longer than I wish I had. But I was more of a grouser and a grumbler up until that point, seeing, you know, the Jews are complaining about the Holocaust again. They're extorting the Germans again. They're extorting us again, you know, and wondering when it will ever end. And then also part of me always kind of figured how much control could they possibly have in a being only 2% of the public. Even I didn't realize how much media control they had until 9/11. Now, when I saw 9/11 occur, I think I told you earlier, I was out of corporate. I haven't been back in corporate since about 2000, early 2000, before 9/11 anyhow. And I ended up being out doing working for a contractor. I was back out painting houses. And I'm in the vicinity of the Hanscom Air Force Base here in Massachusetts. And I was out in Acton, which is only a mile away from the Hanscom Air Force Base. And I was working on painting a house. And all that morning, I noticed there wasn't any air traffic. And that's an interesting thing when you're right under an Air Force Base to not have any air traffic. But it seemed very oppressively quiet. So at one point, I grabbed the illegal immigrant that happened to work for the guy, too. And I said, Fernando, let's go get some coffee. We went to Dunkin' Donuts. And we were standing in line, and they had television. That's the point. They started putting televisions in all these stores for some reason, and now they're in all these banks. And I was standing in line, and that's the first I saw about 10:30. I saw the first clip of the South Tower falling. And as I was standing there watching this, all the other people around me apparently had seen this already because they weren't reacting. But I looked up, and I saw the South Tower, and I saw the top 20 or 30 floors start tipping. And they got to about I have a good mechanical grasp of reasoning. And I saw that the top 20 or 30 floors tipping to about 30 degrees. And I expected to see it continue to fall and crumble and then probably fall and crush a building under it. And it just disintegrated in midair. And at the same time, the building immediately under it started just vaporizing. And as I looked at it, I said out loud, and I'm sure everybody heard me, I said, "That's blinking impossible." And that was the first I saw it. Then I was like everybody else, my jaw dropped, but that kept playing in my head because that's all I'd seen for the rest of the day up until I got home to see, you know, catch more of what the story was. And that just kept playing in my mind. It's like,
we had said how the people who sat in front of their TV sets all day, who were home in the morning and saw it and then just sat there watching it, it really got a big dose of what
propaganda.
Propaganda. But you had another word for it. It was imprinting.
Yes.
So, and I was not, you know, I really wasn't very interested when I first heard it. And I thought, oh, now we're going to have to listen to this stuff for the next few weeks. And I didn't know it was going to be the next forever. You know, it was never going to be the next few years. We don't see that stuff much anymore, but it's still an issue. Anyway.
Sure. The interesting thing people don't understand about memories is that when you learn something, when you memorize something, when something is really forced onto your mind, you develop a memory. It's actually physically embedded into your brain. You actually, the function of the roles in your brain is that they keep adding as you learn new things and as you memorize new things. So if you're sitting there all day long being subjected to these horrific images, and then they start tying names to them and start saying Osama bin Laden, within hours they were saying it was Osama bin Laden. And even interjecting that maybe Iraq had something involved with it, and there was Al-Qaeda and all these things, that they were all in cahoots together. These things, it's not just the function of propaganda in this instance is that it actually imprints and embeds this memory into your brain, and you can't get it out of your brain without some serious work. It's a physical reality. So it's not just something that you can wipe away.
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
so that's why they do that. They know that, and they knew what they were doing.
Of course, yeah.
Lucky. I went. I had a trip out of town planned, and it was something I had to do in the city. And I was listening to it on the radio as I was getting ready and as I drove in, but I had not seen a single image. And it wasn't until I got to where I was going that there was a TV in the lobby or something, a bunch of people standing around. So then I had my opportunity to look, and I looked at it, and I looked at all these pictures they were showing. But then I had to go and meet and do my business, and then I left, and, you know, I didn't see it again. I don't have TV at home, so I didn't see it more of it until I saw it at my sports center where I went more regularly then, and would always, it was always there, you know, and I remember starting to be moved by it while I was walking on the treadmill, finally saying, you know, this is really a terrible thing, whereas before, it hadn't fully sunk in to me. So I was fortunate. Well, we're coming up to the end now after I've added my two cents there. And when we get back, ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue with this. I don't mean to cut it off too soon. Let's see the music that I've chosen the first music that I chose for this program for the break. We still have. I want to change it. Not that I don't like this music. It's the German Leader by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, the Gute-Nacht song. It's beautiful. But I do want to change it to something else. I don't want you to think this is permanent. But it might be changed next week, if I'm fortunate. So enjoy it and take a break. And I will be back with my very interesting guest, David Bailey, in 5 minutes after the music. See you then. Hang on.
Herrenhaus, die
Yes, that is really an exquisite musical experience every time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. And my guest is David Bailey. We've already done 1 hour. And I want to remind you that his website is at NEMW.net, not com.net. All right. We were talking about 9/11. We had gotten up to that as a defining experience for so many people, not even just Americans, as a wake-up, more of a wake-up than what they had had before, or maybe the first wake-up call for so many. So it's important in that, because it's one of those things that is shared by millions, and it's like, what were you doing when 9/11 occurred, and what kind of an impression did it make on you, and what did it lead to? So David was telling us about his, and he was pretty sharp because, you know, David, it sure took me a lot longer to figure out that there was something wrong with that. And it wasn't until I've said before, it wasn't until the end of 2004 that someone handed me a bunch of videos. And the first one I watched was In Plain Sight, which I still think is a good video. And woke me up, and I said, my gosh, you know, I never was in love with the 9/11 thing, or but I did basically had come to believe it, and I didn't question it, even though once you're shown about those just the collapsing buildings, let alone all the other stuff they came up with, it's just like, wow, why didn't I see that myself before? So that's what it took for me. Now, I don't want to imply that I think that everything in that video or other videos was absolutely correct or right, that there weren't some mistakes or things that were talked about. But basically, I think that In Plain Sight was pretty good. A lot more was done after that. That was just some of the beginning work. And so let me just stop there. I've gone on long enough. And David, continue with what you were saying about when you found out about it. I mean, what you figured out about it.
Sure. Well, Carolyn, I could listen to you all day, so that's not a problem. I knew right away that the what they were saying wasn't right, and that's basically what made me decide I'd better get involved. One way or another, and I went to various different places, different perspectives, different ideas, different people saying, you know, the Alex Joneses and the other, all these other people that are kind of like Alex Jones, but maybe not as famous and popular as Alex Jones, that had their own spins, like you said, in plain sight. There's Mike Delaney's work that came much later.
Yes.
And all these other, the loose change stuff. And all these, you made the comment previously about my website kind of having a lot of different stuff on it. And that's true. To a certain extent, I think that if somebody will pick up on just one of those things and start wondering, from whatever perspective it is, why we've been lied to, then that will take them to the bigger questions, just like it did with me. When I first wanted to find out what really happened on 9/11, I found myself more in the liberals' camp. And that also went hand in hand with the big push to invading Iraq. And I had a big problem with that, and I actually was handwriting placards and putting them into my van window, taping them in my van window, saying, "Say no to war in Iraq," and all these different things, because I could see how scurrilous the Bush administration was. I mean, these people were, they were frothing at the mouth to invade Iraq, and I couldn't understand that, because they didn't prove anything that they said about Iraq, and I saw that, and I couldn't understand why the public was so willing to go along with that. I mean, we're supposed to be a nation that has values and principles, and yet here we are going all over the world attacking all sorts of countries for really spurious reasons, and draining the swamp, some of them said, and all these different things. Well, if somebody invaded us, and I've used this example many times since then, if the Chinese came here and invaded us, I would imagine that it would be my duty, as well as the duty of any able-bodied, red-blooded American, to get his hands on weapons and make a point of fighting. Even if it looks hopeless, that we should stand and fight because it's a foreign invader, number one, and number two, it's an alien invader, in essence. They're not us. But I ended up bouncing around a lot after 9/11 between these people and those people, and they're saying that, and they're trying to prove it this way, and they're trying to prove it that way. I still get information from the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and they have a new film out. And all these people do is that they're basically making money, and they push other agendas. I followed Alex Jones, say, for a good year. A good year to almost 2 years. I bought a couple of his films. I was going on his website and downloading his podcast. And I think he's the best at making you crazy, because everything is an emergency with him. And I understand that all these presidential signings from Bush to Obama, yes, they're very much to be concerned with. But Alex Jones puts you in a tizzy, so that you're always feeling like you're attacked, and then you start feeling hysterical all the time. And that was a problem. I mean, that, just on a personal level, that was a problem, because I always felt anxiety. And then on the other side of the coin, the people like Jason Burmes that he was dealing with, I never confirmed. After a point, I didn't even care. I started feeling like Jason Burmes has ulterior motives himself, because I remember people would call in and start saying, "What about the Jewish angle involved with this? What about the Jewish angle involved with this?" And both Alex Jones and Jason Burmes, who used to sit in for him sometimes, would say, calling them anti-Semites, and start trying to imply that, you know, if you listen to these other people, you know, they're neo-Nazis and they're haters and whatever, and We just want to expose our government's complicity in this. And then, of course, after a while, you know, one or two of the guys involved with him came out with their own difference. I forget what they called the film. I got it too, but they highlighted the fact that in fact Israel had a hand in it too. And you just start wondering at that point, all right, you can't get any on the major media, you can't get anybody to even talk about it. In the alternative media, all the major people in the alternative media do their damnedest to try to deflect any criticism of Jews, or they'll say, okay, Israel had a hand in it, but it wasn't Jews in general, which I'm sure most Jews don't really know what Israel does. They just support Israel because it's their own ethnicity, and even though they're liberals for the most part, they're still chauvinistic enough that they will support their own people, whatever their differences are. And I just felt like, okay, anywhere I go, most people, unless I join the quote-unquote neo-Nazi camp, I'm going to have to avoid talking about the Jewish angle in Israel. So I decided, okay, I'm going to have to make a point of dealing with the neo-Nazis, or what they keep calling neo-Nazis. At this point, after studying up on Nazism and all that, I don't really understand what they mean by neo-Nazi. If you're a Nazi, you're a Nazi. I think when they say neo-Nazi, maybe they mean the more violent skinhead type people that tend to be of a fascistic nature. And as much as some of them might be brainless, and just willing to get into the mud pit and fight, I think we need those people too. You know, we can't all
absolutely.
Just be...
We need fighters. We need people willing to go out and fight, and we've seen that. You need all the different elements, just like you have in a society.
And that's right.
That's why, going back to Hitler again, you know, he didn't want just certain types to be what everybody should try to be, or the only ones that were important, but the society was made up with all elements of what's called classes and levels of people, and people in different who have different abilities, and everybody had to work together.
Absolutely.
To make the nation work. And that's what while we don't like to see some of these what they call costume Nazis, you know, want to wear the uniform and stuff, they really are either oddballs, or they're working for the government, or they're just people who like to go to the extreme. Some of the people in there are good people, but a lot of it is not helpful. But that doesn't mean that that you still don't want different elements. And if some people dress, I'm not saying in the uniforms, but if some people dress in black T-shirts and want to shave their head, so what? That's no reason to reject them, unless they're being troublesome.
Absolutely. As long as they're focused. As long as they're serving a purpose and not just being violent for the sake of being violent and doing stupid things. Even Hitler had the brown shirts. And Hitler would not have gotten far had he not had men willing to commit themselves physically to the fight. Because if Hitler had gone out into the world to speak, he would be attacked by communists. And if you don't have guys around you who are willing to pick up a club and beat the communists down, you're going to get your own butt kicked.
That's right. And look, now today we have these anti-racists who attack anyone who they consider to be any racial groups. And they go, they break the law. They're horrible. And
they
do real damage. I mean, I'm not going to go into it. There's lots of stories recently about what they've done. And they are hardly punished for it. But anyway... this was what was going on then, and they had to defend themselves. Now we have this huge police presence, which if you get permission to do a march, you know, then the police are out there. There's more police than anything else in their black, you know, look like the Darth Vader uniforms or whatever. And they're standing all around and holding back these violent left-wing anti-racists from attacking these nationalist group marchers. Well, they'd go in and tear them to pieces. But we are not allowed to fight back, so we have to depend on the police and just stay very passive and, you know, quiet. And then they reroute them you know, at the last minute, or they say, well, the crowd is too wild, you can't march any further than three blocks, and then you have to disband or something. You know, I mean, it's terribly unfair. But anyway, this, you know, the fact that there's all these violent people on the other side of this is...
Of course. Well, they have the majority of the people that aren't working. They have the majority of the... Well, it's true.
That's right.
Let's be honest. I mean, the people who are on welfare, the illegal immigrants, all these, that's where the Antifa get their people from. All these illegal Hispanics, or I know you don't like the term Hispanics, but mestizos or Chicanos, they used to be called in the 70s.
Yeah.
All those people, the people who are on welfare from the ghettos. I mean, these people don't have jobs. These people, you know, for the most part, I mean, they have all the time in the world to get out and cause trouble and do whatever the heck they want. So
it's like so many of those people, and this makes me think of the, so many of the Jewish people in the National Socialist camps during the war. There were so many of them that that couldn't work, or all kinds of women who weren't expected to work, or, you know, all the people who weren't expected to work. Thousands and thousands of them who were just fed and taken care of, and, you know, in these places, and no harm was going to come to them, although they've created all this, these fables. Well, you know, I don't want to go off into things. I'm going to bring in right now, since we're talking about the National Socialists again. Hadding Scott has sent in a correction. You know, he's the historical accurate guy, and I don't know if this is probably right, but I still think Goebbels said it too. But he says that he writes in and says that it was Himmler at Posen in 1943 who said that every German had a favorite Jew. Remember, we were talking about that. And he says, although further marriages of Jews and non-Jews were forbidden, pre-existing mixed marriages were not broken up in order to deport a Jewish spouse. Well, most of the time that's true. I was going to say that, but I didn't. I guess I wasn't sure about in Czechoslovakia or not, and those other places. So he says the most famous example of a mixed marriage that lasted through the war is probably Professor Karl Haushofer and his Jewish wife, friends of Rudolf Hess. I didn't know Carl had a Jewish wife. I've forgotten it. But if I know that in Germany, when they started making those laws, they had all these categories for how Jewish you were, and if they made an exception for Jews who were married to Germans and had children, especially. They did not break up those families, and that Jew was allowed to remain. So. But I still think that Goebbels also said that. I've seen him quoted in some of the things he wrote or said. And also I think that Hitler repeated that too as a, you know, a story, kind of a funny story. Not funny, but, you know, when they were anecdote, when they were talking about these things. So, but anyway, we know, according to Hadding, that Himmler said that at Posen. Yeah, I remember that Posen speech. Yes, but he may have gotten it from Goebbels, you know. It's very possible. Goebbels is pretty clever. All right, so that's that. Thank you, Hadding. And so continue.
Okay, well, just to get to the present and where my thinking finally settled up, is that I became aware that basically there are a lot of gatekeepers involved in this struggle. From mainstream media right into the alternative media. And, I mean, I've dealt with it myself personally. We have a station here in the Boston area, 96.9, that advertises itself as a conservative station. And I've called to them on two occasions. One was in the afternoon while I was driving home from doing a job somewhere and talking to this skinny white guy from Gloucester that looks like he's dying of AIDS, but he claims to be a ladies' man. And it was during the election. He does a lot of babbling. And I was listening to it, and a person I heard he cut off that was talking about the wars. And I got very angry with that because I knew about the PNAC documents and all this stuff and how it goes all the way back to Netanyahu in the mid-90s. And they had this big whole thing worked out about making the Middle East fall one country by one. And I saw basically it was, you can see it in action. The whole from Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, all of them, they're doing the whole shebang right now. And it's obvious. If you know the story from not just yesterday, but you go back 10 years, you go back 20 years, and in this case, I mean, the further I looked, the longer the shadow was, all the way back to World War II, all the way back to World War I, all the way back to the 1890s. I mean, it's there. The whole history is just laid out. Well, I got on the phone and I started talking, and as soon as I mentioned the PNAC documents, boom, they had a technical difficulty and my call was dropped. One Sunday, not too long after that, I was driving back from somewhere doing a job because I work practically every day. And on the Sundays, for some reason, they have a black communist. Go figure. I don't know. This is a conservative radio station. And he was giving his Obama spin on, this is post-election, and he's giving his Obama spin on why Obama wasn't pulling out of Afghanistan right away like he said he would, and he wasn't committing to pulling the troops out of Iraq right away like he said he would. So I got on the phone, and I'd already realized that Obama really was going to be Bush 2 at that point. I knew that 18 months before the election was over because he changed the story slowly but surely over that period. And I called up, and as soon as I mentioned the PNAC documents, boom, I had phone trouble again and got disconnected. So they'll do it everywhere, even local radio stations. And yeah, it just becomes discouraging when – and I've heard people calling into Alex Jones' show and be written off as anti-Semites or whatever if they start bringing up Israel or Zionism or whatever that's related to the Jewish question. And I started looking elsewhere. I started realizing that there are gatekeepers everywhere, even in the alternative press and even in local press, there are gatekeepers. And I ultimately ended up, I think, probably first and foremost checking out Alex Linder's site in the Vanguard News Network. Mm-hmm. And around that time, say the 2005, 2006, he started trying to get his own, podcasts off the ground. He had a couple of different shows with different people like James Hawthorne from Britain, mm-hmm. With the Aryan.
Yeah, I know him. Yeah.
Yep. And these were people that were saying things that you don't really hear anywhere. And information that you don't see every day. And I started thinking, well, I know this to be true, and I know that to be true. And I never knew this, and I never knew that, as these people were talking, saying, well, you know, here are people who are not afraid to say what they know to be the truth. And they're pointing out things that I've noticed myself about Alex Jones and mainstream media. So all these things basically started haunting me, reminding me about what my grandmother used to say about watching TV in the 70s and realizing that the Jews were manipulating our society through controlling the media. Mm-hmm. And my site, NEMW.net, was originally going to be a web development site. It was New England Media Works because I was going to be a web developer and host websites. I do out of my own basement. I have the servers in my basement.
Oh, that's great. Good for you. Wow, that's what we need. We need a lot of know-how people like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't get to put a lot of time into it. So
no.
I got it up and running anyhow. But then I decided, okay, you know what? I'm going to jump into the fight too and, you know, do whatever I can to try to get the word out. I mean, I knew lots of normal people. I don't know. I didn't know Carolyn Yeager at the time. I didn't know Michael Piper, that's another person. I started listening to RBN as well. Mm-hmm. And hearing people like Michael Piper talking and really delving into Jewish power in this country. And these people were confirming to me what my grandmother had already said that she lived through already practically a century ago, you know, that she'd seen over the course of her life. So that...
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. No, you finish.
Okay.
So I have a question for you.
Okay. I mean, that just basically confirmed to me that I was on the right path, and that the problem we have, especially with the media controlling democratic politics, is that their thought processes are manipulated. They have certain beliefs that they're are instilled in them through the school system, through whatever media they're exposed to, and then they get a choice to become either a Republican, which is supposedly conservative, but then you kind of wonder what are conservatives actually trying to conserve if they don't have any principles? And then you have the Democrats, and the Democrats have always been communists, period. So,
yeah,
you know, or liberal communists, or I guess there are so many, the language itself is so fraught with danger. When you say a liberal, well, what do you mean by liberal? If you say communist, what do you mean by communist? And same with socialist. I mean, the National Socialists were socialists, but that doesn't mean they were communists.
Mm-hmm. And That's so true. They keep a lot of people really confused.
Exactly.
With this stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. So when I was going to go to college to become either a journalist or an English professor. So I've always had a keen interest in the power of language. And it's something that's always been near and dear to my heart, is understanding how language is used to manipulate people. So to me, when I see all these talking heads saying what they say and politicians saying what they say, I realize that they're using language to deceive us. And, you know, they put a happy face on whatever it is that they want to sell us, more or less. But go ahead and ask me a question. I'm sorry.
Okay, and then I've got another question for you, which will fit into this. So, but I'll ask you first. What you're saying is that 9/11 is what really got you started. And it got so many started. But since you are basically conservative, it didn't lead you into where so many of the liberals went with it. Although, you know, all sides can see that the government story is false. Now, what I wanted to point out was that we mentioned gatekeepers, and most of the gatekeepers are the liberals, it seems to me, although people have said that Alex Jones is a gatekeeper, and he presents himself as a patriot, right, on the right, sort of. But you can't go by any of these way people present themselves. But here's what I want to bring up to you. You know, I think you know that last Monday on my Heretics Hour program, I did bring up 9/11, probably for the first time, in relationship to the fact that I was noticing that white nationalists, for lack of a better term, or white identity people, so many of the leadership, I don't know, and maybe some of the rank and file, but of the people that I've been noticing lately, they don't like the 9/11 story. They don't like 9/11 truth. They make fun of the truthers just the same way as the believers in the official story do. And I was very surprised to learn that. Now you are one that is not that way, and you're a racialist. So there are those, of course. I'm another one, but the ones with the big names, you know, the well-known names that people consider the leaders, and I won't go through them because I'm being accused of saying, you know, disparaging these people. But I found that they all are not at all interested in 9/11. They basically stop at the fact that it was blowback by the Islamic world, and that was justified, but still it was the Muslims who did it. And you know, it was they accept that the Muslims got on these planes and flew them into these buildings, these hijackers. They accept all this stuff, which I find just amazing, but it's because they don't look into it. They've looked at the surface of it, and then they say, well, you know why? Because it doesn't fit their political view. They think it doesn't help white racial identity because these are a lot of white people, and they would rather blame the Muslims. And this bothers me that we're not putting truth first. And one of the points of that program was that two things that get in the way of truth for everybody, nobody's immune to it, is their politics and whether it helps their politics, whether something helps their politics or not, and their personal ambition or projects that they're working on, that they, if maybe it doesn't help those projects, that once we get going with something, we want it very much to succeed, you know. So we're no different than the corporate people in that respect, who only want their corporation to keep going and being successful, and presidents who just want to keep being president until they can't any longer, and so on. So what is your comment on this as relates to 9/11 truth?
I think there are various reasons that different people on the right would want to say that and want to avoid that issue, maybe because they want to curry favor with the media, which is controlled by the Jews. Maybe they have benefactors that are, say, Zionist interests. I find it very interesting that you have right-leaning, very right-leaning, supposedly, political parties in France like Le Pen and these other people running to genuflect in Israel and you know, side with Zionism, when the fact of the matter is, if you do look into 9/11 with any seriousness, you do see the hand of Israel. Even William Pierce, in fact, I told you earlier, I keep all of Dr. Pierce's broadcasts on my iPhone. Yeah. And if I'm driving in traffic, and I've heard your story or Bill Fink's latest podcast, and I've got nothing new to listen to, instead of listening to the radio, I'll put on a chapter from Mein Kampf, or I'll put on something that Dr. Pierce did. Mm-hmm. And very recently, I mean, I heard a couple of stories, a couple of his broadcasts pertaining to us bombing Serbia and 9/11. And Dr. Pierce, you have to remember, Dr. Pierce died in 2002. And he was not privy to a lot of information, like several of the hijackers that turned up alive in other countries, other information about what actually hit the Pentagon or didn't hit the Pentagon, how the plane went down in Pennsylvania, but there are no plane parts and no bodies to be found. And I think he was quick to jump on the notion that this is blowback in the Middle East because of our support of Israel, hell or high water. And I obviously, with Dr. Pierce, he was a curmudgeonly fella, and I think part of it suited his sense of the absurd, that we had it coming. And I think he kind of had a kind of glee over the notion that this could be it. This could be the thing that makes Americans wake up to the serious danger that's siding with Israel and Jews cost Americans. And I think he was hoping that this would open the eyes of a lot of Americans. And perhaps maybe
That's a real good point, because as you said, he didn't have time to figure it all out. And, you know, he died so soon afterwards, and how many people had figured anything out by then? Well, you did.
Right.
You weren't talking about it. I mean, you didn't have a listenership or anything.
Well, I didn't know all the ins and outs. I only saw the South Tower come down, and I knew something was wrong.
Yeah. He didn't, because people are focused on their own program, and if it looks like this could help the white racial movement, which was Dr. Pierce's concern, then he would see what he wanted to see for that. And I don't blame him, because he, like I say, wasn't around that long. But people who have been around still, you know, and don't want to look at it because it's not going to help their message or their movement, I think that's a fault, because in the end, just like you were just saying, was why I broke in, is that it hasn't. You know, all this has come out and we're still, it hasn't changed anything. So obviously, if you don't get the real truth, and this is my, you know, I know you can, I know I could be just a little Pollyanna about truth and say, oh, ain't it truth no matter what, but, and people see truth differently, but still, we have to go for the truth. And if you don't, you're not, whatever you think is going to help you, probably in the end won't, because it's not yet the truth. Or well, why, you're not putting the truth out to people.
Right. Why fight with one hand tied behind your back?
Okay.
It's basically the thing. And like I said, I think maybe some of these people have ulterior motives for, you know, wanting to curry favor with certain factions within the Jewish community.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I really hope not. And I'm not saying that any of these people are doing it. I think they have other reasons. But anything is possible. I mean, they need to, you know.
Well, you have Le Pen, for one.
Well, that person, yeah. I'm thinking about these American
I know these Americans too, but I think it's odd. Now, I've heard other people on, say, the network you were formerly affiliated with, that that the young fella there, Stark, and he's entertained discussions with people that are pro-Zionist. And if you accept the notion that 9/11 was carried out, as I do, I'm not going to say everybody should feel the way I do. There are a lot of people say 9/11 is an inside job and Israel helped. I would prefer to look at it that Israel, well, number one, we're controlled by Jewish power, but Israel is the fountainhead from where this comes from. And they have lots of key players and key positions in our government, and they also have our own politicians in their back pocket. So if you accept the notion that Israel, which is Zionism, is involved in attacking us on 9/11, as well as the Levant affair, as well as the USS Liberty, and all these other things, then basically to side with Zionism, or you'd want to deny 9/11 being what you should accept it is an attack by Israel. You basically have to discard all your Zionist buddies and accept the fact that you're promoting kinship with somebody who's attacked your own country. So they can't go out of there, that's just on that level. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the level, they want to curry favor with Zionism because Zionism is racism, right? It's Jewish racism.
Yeah.
So for them to be acceptable to a Zionist, say, media, for lack of a better way of saying it, and for them to have to be able to express their racial views, they have to curry favor with Zionist players. So you have to pick. So in this world, you have to pick your poison ultimately if you don't want to use the truth. Either you side with the Zionists who attacked this country. I mean, there's no question Netanyahu knows exactly what went down. He was no doubt a player involved with it. He was involved with the PNAC documents. The PNAC documents called for a Pearl Harbor type event to mobilize the United States in favor of supporting Israel, even if it comes to war. Or you have to choose the liberal type of Jew, which is puts out the bumper sticker that says coexist and says we're all the same race, we're all the human race, and we can't have our own identities as white people, and we have to accept that we've got all these black people here already, and we have to accept that they rape our women and commit crimes on us and bring more of them here and let the mestizos take over the Southwest. You get one poison or another. And even then, that's a joke, because the neocons are basically Trotskyites. They are basically communists, but they are communists that are rabidly pro-Israel. So they're Jewish racialists, but they have no problem using the United States and the gullible people of the United States to further their interests. So as to what your question about these supposed white nationalist type people, these armchair people, armchair warriors, their motivation, I don't know. I assume that they're trying to curry favor either with the Zionist faction, because that's how they expect to get some kind of money out of the deal, or some kind of career out of the deal, or some kind of media exposure out of the deal.
It could be. I call them the big tent people. They want a big tent, and they want to include as many people as they can. But here, before we run out of time, there's another question from a listener, and I want to ask it to you. She writes, this is a female. She writes, please ask if he has any examples of Jews pretending to be Muslims. For example, the Iranian Jew pretending to be an Iranian Muslim. An Iranian Jew pretending to be an Iranian Muslim, or actual Arabic Iranian Muslims working for Jews and against their own people.
Okay. Well, some time ago, there was that fellow, as a matter of fact, that was supposedly a part of Al-Qaeda. And I believe his grandfather was involved with the ADL. And of all places, that came out on Alex Jones's show. I can't remember his name now, because that goes back about 4 or 5 years. But yeah, he was a Jewish fellow from California that was releasing videotapes as an Al-Qaeda spokesman, and he was portraying himself to be a Muslim. That's one for you right there.
Okay.
And actually, if you look into other things that go on, I mean, they're attacking us on so many fronts. If you remember, they were trying to pass that domestic terrorism bill, H.R. 1955, and that was being pushed by that Jewess out of California. I don't remember. She owns the Newsweek now. She and her husband own Newsweek. The whole panel they had, in fact, it's probably somewhere on my website. I linked to it. They had a discussion in Congress about it. They had a hearing. It's about an hour long, and all the panelists that they came, these experts, they're always experts, each one of them, except for the black guy, there was one black person involved, congressman, all these people were Jews. And they all somehow infiltrated Muslim networks and Al-Qaeda, and were snooping on the internet, finding all these websites that show you how to be a terrorist and all these things. And each one of them was a Jew.
Yeah.
Except for the black guy. And they're trying to sell this domestic terrorism bill, H.R. 1955.
Yeah, and there you are. See, and you know, when you're dealing with Semites, you can't tell them apart, so Jews can pretend to be Muslims. And I don't know what the motivation of this question is, but it's that maybe we have to watch out for Muslims, because, you know, who are supposedly being anti-Jewish when they're really Jews and setting things up, or...
well, we know they do that, though, Carolyn.
They're working for Jews against their own people. So that should make us a little bit, maybe give more consideration to Muslims, because maybe they're getting a bad name because of what actually Jews pretending to be Muslims are doing. Or maybe she means that those Muslims who boarded the planes and attacked the World Trade Centers were really Jews. Not Muslims, but, you know, I don't think that anybody boarded planes and flew into the towers. What's your opinion on that? We'll just clarify.
On the towers, I think that, if anything, those planes were radio controlled, and I don't think all of them were planes. We don't have any record of the one that went down in Pennsylvania as being an actual plane. There were no parts.
That's a weird thing. That's really weird.
Yes, and the Pentagon...
One of these white nationalist leaders who said... Well, we don't know what happened there, and just left it at that, like it didn't matter. We don't have to answer those questions.
Right, and the same is true of the Pentagon.
And why they wanted to destroy those buildings, but we don't know why that plane went down in Pennsylvania.
That's true, and the same is true of the Pentagon. And there have been Air Force pilots on record as saying nobody could have made the turn that supposedly a passenger jet made to slam into the building, and there aren't any plane parts from that either. And not enough collateral damage. I mean, if you see pictures of that area that got hit and the size of a 757, there would have been at least wing parts left. There would have been something there other than a hole in the wall.
So, you know, what I really think is that these people don't they're not being so dishonest, but they don't want to go into 9/11 because they think it's a distraction.
Well, they don't want to be seen as quacks.
Well, but they think it's a distraction from the racial issues, and they're happy to blame the Muslims because that helps the racial story for them in their point of view.
Sure. I'm not condoning any
that's
love.
That's just it. They really haven't studied it. Like I pointed out, if you're going to understand something, the same with the Holocaust. These are the same people who don't want to bring the Holocaust in. They probably know in themselves that it's a big hoax, but they don't think it's good for white nationalism because it's people have such such a demonization of it. They don't want to be connected with it, so they just would rather ignore it. And that's basically what they're doing with both of those incidents, which really need to be. Really need to be exposed, both of them.
Absolutely.
I think for us to move forward, I don't think we can ignore them. And that's been my beef. So,
There's no way that we can avoid or should dismiss the topics of 9/11 and the hoax. And especially 9/11, because it's happened in recent times, the people we're trying to open eyes for are people who have experienced it firsthand. And 9/11 is a linchpin to making people realize that there's a far bigger problem than Muslims. I don't condone us bringing Muslims here. I don't condone the wars in the Middle East or the other troubles we're starting in Syria and Lebanon and Libya and all these other places. The Democrats are just as guilty as the Republicans for fomenting these upheavals. They're following the PNAC documents in their own way that the Bush government was following. They just do it with a smile on their face and saying they're doing it for humanitarian reasons. I mean, they said the same thing about Serbia. And those were our own people that we were fighting, white people, white Europeans, that were trying to keep Muslims from taking chunks of European territory. But the Democrats were doing so. That appeals to the liberal sensibility. They say we're doing it for humanitarian reasons. Republicans say we're doing it for patriotic reasons. And basically, they're two hands on the same, you know, the same misfit, more or less. They're two sides of the same coin. They're doing the same job. They're just putting a different face on it. And the hardest thing to do is make a Republican realize that their side is our scumbags. And making a Democrat realize that what they're espousing are a bunch of lies too, because they get wrapped up in the other politics involved. When you deal with a Democrat, they'll say that they might be kind of iffy on the whole humanitarian going into Libya and killing Gaddafi, even though, I mean, what they did to him was really butcherous. But they push forward their happy social domestic agenda of bringing Somalis and Sudanese here and feeding them on our dime.
You know, an opinion on the Osama bin Laden death or shootout or whatever it was that occurred, I guess it was last year now or this year even, but recently, where they say they finally got him. This just came to mind. I'm just curious myself. Do you have an opinion, a pretty strong opinion, one way or the other, whether you think that Osama was killed earlier or died much earlier, or whether they really did kill him then?
Well, you know, in all honesty, does it matter if he's alive or dead? No, because I don't believe he was behind anything. But Bhutto, Benavir Bhutto, said that that Osama bin Laden was dead back in 2006, yeah. And then 2 weeks later, she was assassinated.
Yeah, of course, there are other reasons they could have assassinated her, but that's one thing. It doesn't prove anything, but
it's, no, it doesn't prove it one way or another. But
it's kind of a hunch. My hunch has always been that he did die back then, because you never saw. I mean, all the new videos of him and audios, where they put out audios then with just a picture of him, and then his voice. Well, we know they can do that, and all of this fake stuff they've done all the time. They never could show the man as actually being alive and being around. And so then you know that those Al Qaeda people who were saying that were saying that Osama was still their leader, they were just agents of the government, of our government too, or the Israel or whatever. So then they come up with this death thing, or oh, we captured him, we killed him, and we dumped his body in the ocean. It's all so insane and stupid that I can't possibly believe it. I think, and that just is even more reason to say, what the heck is our government doing? But you know, most people, the media has just played right along with it. And of course, I don't know what most people think, but all you hear is what the media tells you that people are saying.
Basically. Oh, sure. Well, Obama gets political clout out of it from his people, because he said, well, Obama got him.
Yeah.
Well, if he was in Pakistan all this time, I mean, Benavir Bhutto said he was dead. She was running for president of Pakistan. If they knew where he was, they knew where he was. They were shielding him,
yeah.
Right? Pakistan is supposedly an ally of him. If they're shielding him, just like the Afghanis were, then why aren't we at war with Pakistan?
Yeah.
See, this is the thing that our government plays around a lot. Mm-hmm. About this and that, and you know, this looks good for Obama, for the Democrats. They say, well, Obama got, well, no, he didn't. He didn't get him, and we already know that he was a CIA operative, Tim Osman. He worked for us, helping supply arms to the Mujahideen.
Yeah.
I mean, is he a friend or an enemy? You know, they cloud the water so much. That they can make whatever political hay they want out of it anytime they want. So
okay, David, we have about 7 minutes maybe left. So is there something that I haven't brought up, or that you know that you would like to say that hasn't come up in today's program? Because I know you're into a lot of things and.
Well, there's never enough to say, Carolyn. There's so many things going on, and we're being attacked on so many different fronts and so many different angles. It's hard to focus on any one thing. I mean, we could talk all day, and I'm surprised how quickly these 2 hours actually passed. but the political situation in this country is very tricky, and we have right now a fight to try to get Ron Paul to take over the Republican nomination. Back in 2008 or 2007, whatever, when he first announced this thing, and I was still kind of a follower of, or still half listening to Alex Jones at that point, they tried to make it up that Ron Paul was serious about going after what happened on 9/11 and opening the investigation up again, and he was going to do this and that about the Fed. And then he dropped out on his own. And he could have gone third party if he wanted to. He would have brought all those people that were liberals, he would have brought all, and anti-war, he would have brought all those people who were dissatisfied with the direction of the Republican Party and realized the Republican Party was full of baloney. Mm-hmm. And he would have brought, no doubt, a majority of the great unwashed middle that goes where the best story is. Not the diehard Republicans or the diehard Democrats. You'll never get that 20% of either of those parties. He had a great chance, and then when he had the opportunity, he backed off and he threw all his cards in the wind and said, "You can vote for any of these other third party candidates." And now he's back again, and the only thing that I think, and I'm happy to work for it, to see that happen, if only to see that if he were in fact to take the election away or the primary away from Mitt Romney and actually beat Obama, would anything change in reality? Or would there be some way that they would deny even a popular president? And he would have to be very popular to get his way. I mean, they keep saying that about mandates with Bush and mandates with Obama, that these men's overwhelming popularity justify them pulling any kind of policy that they want. If for nothing else, I would like to see Ron Paul win just to prove that the political system is that much hocus pocus. Now, I went to the Massachusetts Republican caucus here last month.
Oh.
And a couple towns down from me on 495 in Littleton.
You do keep busy.
I try.
Tell
you. Yeah. I try. I got word from a couple of operatives on the Campaign for Liberty that they were going to go down there as nominees to go to Florida as delegates. So I went down, and they got a fair bunch of us, as a matter of fact. We went down and saw a lot of party hacks that were there, and I can say this on your show, but there was one fella, Alan something, I forget what his last name was, he's a Jewish guy, sweaty, beady-eyed, a complete caricature, and he was a Republican operative. As soon as I got there, you could see his eyes were boring into me. He was just couldn't wait to come over and glad hand and pass his papers around. And he was, I think he was running for a rep of some town or district. And he was there for the delegate choice and whatnot. And they had X amount of party hacks there. They were all going to fly down and they're all pro Romney. Well, they had six guys that were under the auspices of what they call the Reagan Liberty something party. I forget. And each one of them got up and they gave a quick speech and they overwhelmingly won by 2/3 over the party hacks. And you could see that the party hacks were not happy at all. And I just found out recently from another fellow that was there who's running for the representative of my district that the Massachusetts Republican Party is doing everything it can in the books to get these guys taken off as delegates because they won. And they know that if it goes to a second vote, that they will lose.
All right. I have to break in now. We've got less than 30 seconds. And I want to thank you, David Bailey. And your website is nemw.net. And you are on Facebook as Associated Tradesman, showing all the hard work you do. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for listening. And so give you a chance to say goodbye, too, David.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, for having me on. It was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure. Mutual. Talk to you again.
All right.
Bye-bye. Good night, everybody. Bye. Keep safe.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.